for a song which we call The Reluctant Cannibal.
Seated one day at the tom-tom, I heard a welcome shout from the kitchen. Come and get it. Roast leg of insurance salesman. A chorus of yums ran round the table. Yum, 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 yum. Except for Junior, who pushed away his shell, got up from his log, and said,
I don't want any part of it.
What?
Why not?
I don't eat people.
Hey?
I won't eat people.
Huh?
I don't eat people.
I must be going deep.
Eating people is wrong.
It's wrong.
Don't eat people.
You've gone clean out of your mind.
I won't eat people.
What's the matter with the lad?
Don't eat people.
He keeps on repeating. Eating people is bad. But people have always eaten people. What else is there to eat? If the juju had meant us not to eat people, he wouldn't have made us of meat.
Don't eat people.
Oh, no, not again.
I won't eat people.
All the day long. Don't eat people, he keeps on repeating. Eating people is wrong. Well, I never heard a more ridiculous idea in all my born days. To think that a son of mine should grow up to be a sissy. Me, chief assistant to the assistant chief. I suppose you realize, son, if this was to get around, we might never get self-government.
I won't eat people.
Have you been talking to one of your mothers again? You're not getting to be one of these cranks that thinks that eating people is cruel, are you? You're seeing a man sitting in a pot and you think he's suffering. Oh, it's not like that at all. Why, he's just had an invigorating chase through the forest. He's sitting there in the nice warm water with all the carrots and dumplings and things. He's thinking, oh, the pleasure and happiness I'm going to give to a whole heap of people. That man in the pot there, he enjoys it.
Eating people is wrong.
Look, son, I admire your sincerity. Always be sincere, whether you mean it or not. You're young. When you're young, you think you can change the whole world overnight, even eating people. I know I've been young myself. Take it from your old dad. You've just got to learn to take the world as it is.
I won't let another man pass my lips.
I know why you say don't eat people, because you are a coward, Francis. That's your trouble. You're a yellow-livered coward. You wouldn't mind eating people if you weren't afraid of ending up in the pot yourself. How despicable. Going like this, you're liable to get me into hot water.
I won't eat people.
That's enough.
I don't eat
don't
people.
Don't want
to. Eating people is wrong.
Communist. Going around saying don't eat people, that's the way to make people hate you. We always have eaten people, always will eat people. You can't change human nature.
I don't eat people.
It must have been someone he ate.
People is out.
I give up. He used to be a regular anthropophagi guy. This crazy idealistic idea of yours was to catch on. I just don't know where we would all be. Just about ruin our entire internal economy. Fortunately, I suppose it's catching on isn't really very likely. Why, you might just as well go around saying don't fight people, for example.
Don't fight people?
Don't! Can you imagine? Well, you see, all part of the same fantastical possibility. Oh, that's the boy. Ridiculous.
That was The Reluctant Cannibal by Flanders and Swan, which I offer in place of a reply to anybody who asserts that we've always had war and therefore we will always have war. Now let's continue with another episode from Gwyn Dyer's series about war, this one called The Profession of Arms, looking not at arms dealers but at arms users, looking at the impact of war on a very personal level.
That forward position! Five round magazine! Load!
Junior Leaders Course, Campetawawa, Ontario, Canada. We ask soldiers to kill people who they don't even know whenever we decide those people are the enemy. And we ask them to sign a contract with unlimited liability. By becoming soldiers, they agree to die when they're ordered to. To be able to do such extraordinary things, military men need very special beliefs and attitudes. This film is about how soldiers think about themselves and their job. how they have to think in order to survive and function in combat.
It makes them a group apart, for it's the nature of combat that shapes the military world and the military mind. Combat is an environment where the normal rules of human conduct do not apply. But soldiers are only ordinary people, and the rules of behavior in combat have evolved to deal with that fact. To operate in this environment, people need a special mental framework and a unique form of organization. There's a separate caste of people in every country who devote their lives to maintaining this organization and nurturing the right attitudes to go with it. They are the professional officers. To understand how they must think, we first have to understand how combat actually works. We'll take our examples from anywhere and any time. In the desert or at sea, 5,000 years ago or now, it's always people who are doing the killing and the dying. Technology has now distanced many military men from the reality of what they do, but they still need to live in a special moral world.
I grew up in Vietnam. All those things I'd taken for granted all my life weren't necessarily there anymore. The fact that I had friends that were killed who were very young had a very deep impact on me. Death became a real thing. I am immortal. I'm not sure I ever thought about that. I'm not sure very many 19 or 20 year olds think about that.
So you've got to keep distant from them. The officer enlisted man, distance helps. This is one of the most painful things, is having to withhold sometimes your affection for them and your identification with them, because you know you're going to have to destroy them on occasion. And you do, you use them up, their material. And part of being a good officer is knowing how much of them you can use up and get the job done.
I would draw one distinction between being a combat aviator and being someone who is fighting the enemy face to face on the ground. In the air environment, it's very clinical, it's very clean. And it's not so personalized. You see an aircraft, you see a target on the ground. You're not eyeball to eyeball with the sweat and the emotions of combat. And so it doesn't become so emotional for you and so personalized. And I think it's easier to do in that sense. You're not so affected.
I'm probably the last person you'll ever meet who has used a sword in action on the back of a horse. So that was at the beginning of my service, which ended, of course, after the introduction of nuclear weapons. So that spans, really, the whole gamut of the history of warfare, virtually from the Stone Age to the Space Age. But the essential soldier remains the same, whether he was handling a slingshot weapon on Hadrian's Wall, or whether he's in a main battle tank today, he is essentially the same.
The Golan Heights, where Israel and Syria fight their battles.
This place is called the Valley of Tears. Right around here in 1973, the Syrians lost 260 tanks. Exact Israeli losses are still secret, but they were losing very heavily too. Now, the rule of thumb is that you lose one entire tank crew for every two tanks that are hit. And a tank is not a good place to die. Basically, you burn to death, unless you're lucky enough to be killed outright by whatever gets through the armor plate at you. And yet, both sides kept on with this hellish business all around the clock for almost 4 days. Nobody quit, nobody ran away.
This Syrian crew surrendered only after their tank was burned out.
Persuading men to keep going until they are killed or horribly hurt is the key to military success. It always has been. Whether armies won or lost once depended mostly on their discipline and morale. Officers served mainly as a focus of loyalty, and to attract that loyalty, they had to cultivate the image of the ideal warrior. But once their troops were committed to battle, officers could have little further influence on the outcome. We can see why in the first battle we know much about, when an Egyptian army met its enemy near Armageddon in 1469 BC. The people of this city, Armageddon, watched the battle that followed from these walls, which were then much higher, of course, to find out whether they would live or die. What they saw on the plain below can best be described as a choreographed riot. The Egyptians advanced shoulder to shoulder in ranks four or five deep, with their spears leveled until the shock of contact with the enemy's formation. And then it was pure mob scene. Push and shove and scuffle and stab and try to topple as many of the men facing you as possible, until in only a few minutes the other side started to panic. And then it turned into sheer slaughter for the losers. Most of them were cut down from behind by the Egyptians when they turned and tried to flee, only to find themselves still trapped in their own crowd. Over 3,000 years later, in the English Civil War of the mid-1600s, battles still work much the same way. Individual soldiers struggle to control their terror, and each side's aim is to break down the other side's control. But new kinds of troops are now starting to appear on the battlefield. Not just the traditional pikemen and cavalry, but musketeers and artillery. And officers have many more decisions to make. The advent of firearms is beginning to force armies to spread out over far greater areas. It's no longer enough for an officer to fight bravely and inspire confidence. He now has to manage the battle. Eventually, armies find it necessary to train professional officers in military academies. Moscow, the Malinovsky Tank School.
This institution, like other military academies all over the world, is a symbol of the soldier's eternal struggle against Murphy's Law. In battle, almost everything that can go wrong will. So armies put a huge effort into teaching their officers to impose order on the chaos. The Russians have been doing that here for over 180 years. This palace was originally built for Catherine the Great, but ever since 1812 it's been a military academy where Russian and later Soviet officers have learned the rules of the game. The weapons of war have changed over the years, of course. Cavalry officers once learned how to use horses in battle here. Now it's the Malinovsky Armored Forces Academy. But the basic rules haven't changed.
Teaching officers to impose order on the chaos of battle is a thankless job because the environment of combat cannot be mastered by set rules. Yet the effort must be made, even if success can never be more than partial. And the rules of combat, based on how weapons work and, more importantly, how human nature works under stress, are basically the same for everybody.
Если говорить о тактике действий современных соединений частей.
If we talk about the tactics of modern combined arms units, there's no big difference between our units and, let's say, the Americans.
Наших подразделений частей и тактикой действий возьмем американцев, для примера.
Поэтому все фронты.
Tactics and strategy must be learned, but simply knowing the rules doesn't mean you win the game.
The great secret about military strategy is that there are no secrets about strategy. Any competent soldier can look at the Golan Heights or anywhere else and tell you everything there is to know about the place, militarily speaking, in a few hundred well-chosen words. If you're Syrian, you want to head westwards towards Israel, then you take that route or you take that route. If you're Israeli and you want to stop them, then you make you stand there or there. No secrets, very few surprises. Yet no soldier can tell you how the battle will actually come out. Making the plans is easy enough. Making them work amidst the chaos and destruction and fear of a real battle is very difficult.
Can you tell me how a battle works?
Well, in my opinion, a battle never works. It never works according to plan. That's what I mean.
General Dan Lanner commanded the Israeli forces on the southern half of the Golan Heights during the 1973 war.
Yes, that's right, but the plan is only a common base for changes. Because it's very important it be common. Everybody should know the plan, so you can change easily. But the modern battle is very fluid, and you have to make your decisions very fast, and mostly not according to the original plan.
But at least everybody knows where you're coming from.
And where you're going to, more or less.
But getting there is never certain. General Yossi Ben Hanan commanded a tank brigade on the Golan Heights in 1973. On the sixth day of the war, with only 8 tanks left, he got behind the Syrian front line.
And once we arrived to the rear, we took positions, and all the positions were very exposed. And we opened fire, and for about 20 minutes we destroyed whoever we could see, because we were in a great position there. I decided to charge and try to get that hill, but I had to leave some tanks in cover, and I charged with 6 tanks. They opened fire from the flank with anti-tank missiles, and in a matter of seconds, 3 out of the 6 tanks were blown up. There was a big explosion in my tank. I blew out of the tank. I was left there for a couple of hours. But also, the whole attack was a mistake. I think so.
What's it like when the tank gets hit?
Using some understatement, it's very uneasy. You know, it's not much fun.
I mean, how long do you have when the tank is hit to get clear?
Don't have much. I don't know. It's a big. It depends what hit you. In that particular case, I was my tank was hit by anti-tank missile. It's a very big explosion. And the penetration is an immediate penetration and a big explosion inside.
General Ben Hanan is a very competent officer, but his attack failed and some of his men died. He took a chance and he was wrong. There are so many variables in combat a commander cannot control, and so many things he simply does not know. It happens to everybody in war. For example, on the second day of the 1973 war, the Syrians broke completely through the Israeli defenses on the southern half of the Golan Heights. There were no Israeli troops at all in front of them.
Another 2 hours and they'd be down off the Golan, on the Jordan River crossing, ready to strike into northern Israel itself. So they stopped. During the night, the first Israeli reserves coming up from the south were rushed up here to set up some kind of defense, and the Syrians never got any further. Why did they stop in the first place? The deputy commander of the 47th Brigade, Major Kultum, was captured later by the Israelis, said that this had looked an obvious place for an Israeli defense. The Syrians couldn't see any Israelis, but of course they were here somewhere waiting an ambush. So the Syrians had decided to wait for reinforcements.
It was a mistake, and it cost Syria the whole battle. But if the Syrian commander had taken a chance and pushed on right away, and the Israelis had been waiting in ambush, he would have been wrong too. You can do everything right in combat and still fail. Combat is a high wire act. If you don't move, you risk falling off. If you make the wrong move, the risk is equally great, and there's no way of being certain what the right move is.
Combat between people, it's people trying to stay alive and to kill the other side, is a very complicated game. We come to a stage that military operations should be very, very professional. It's not a game for amateurs anymore.
What makes the job of the officer in combat unique is the constant pressure of having to do something and risk the lives of his men
and also, as far as possible, keep himself alive to go on leading them. Vietnam, 1969.
And as we were going into the position, there was a large rice field we had to walk across. And I remember that I had to send somebody else across first. And you think, well, who do I send? Do I go myself? But being the leader, you can't afford that. And you had to send somebody across. And if you sit back and think about it, you say, well, am I sacrificing this individual? Am I sending him out there to draw fire? That may be part of it. But it's better to send an individual rather than walk out there in your entire force. And I remember pointing to an individual and telling him to go. There was one moment of hesitation that he looked at me and it, do you mean me? Do you really mean it, 9-1? And the look I must have given him, he knew that I meant it, and he went across the field. Everybody was watching that individual. I started sending him across in twos, and it was no problem. Then I took my entire force across. When we were about halfway across, they came up behind us, the VC, and they were in spider holes, and they caught most of my unit in the open. Now, tactically, I had done everything the way it was supposed to be done, but we lost some soldiers. Would I have done it different? I don't think I would have, because that's the way I was trained. Did we lose less soldiers by my doing it that way? That's a question that will never be answered.
You lead by example. I don't think it was unknown that I was afraid to be shot at. I didn't like it. I don't think anyone does. But I did what had to be done given the situation at any given time. And I think that's a contagious type thing. When the shooting starts and things start happening, you do what has to be done. And other people start doing what has to be done, and it's a team effort.
So long as people feel they can improve their chances of survival by acting together, the system usually works. It's when they feel helpless that obedience begins to break down.
As far as losing control, I've always, after the initial 3 or 4 seconds, I felt I was within control of myself. And then that spilled over into control of my people. The only time that I felt that I had no control was when we had incoming. Once I thought I'd lost everything. Matter, I had made my peace with my maker. We were in an open rice paddy, and they were using a 60-millimeter mortar. And we could see the round coming out of the tube. We could see it to where it would peak and then start coming in on us. And it was nothing we could do. People were scattering every which way. Couldn't stand up and scatter, so there's a lot of scurrying around. There was no control there until they ran out of rounds. It was whenever I gained my control back.
Losing control is a polite phrase for panic, and it's always a possibility in war because that is, in the end, what combat is for, to break down the ties that bind armies together, the soldiers' loyalty to each other, and the trust in their officers, which is the ultimate source of obedience. The threat of violent death and the need to inflict death on others always overwhelms the will of some soldiers to go on. If it happens to too many soldiers at once, whole armies can collapse, but that happens only rarely. Armies are very good at getting their soldiers to withstand the most terrible suffering. Usually, the training holds and the command structure goes on working even in the worst of circumstances. Dan Lanner took command as Israel's outnumbered troops on the Golan Heights were on the point of being overrun at the start of the 1973 war.
I think for the first 3.5 days, I never left the radio. I was talking continuously. We were about a distance, about 2,000 yards from the Syrian tanks, because the shot at us, which we didn't like very much. And then you try, in this case, just to quiet everyone down. Stay where you are, hold on as long as you can, and we will sort the thing out.
Camp Gagetown, Canada. Junior officer training, the foundation of the command structure. Here in the scrub of southern New Brunswick, officer candidates in the Canadian Army are being marked on their leadership, on how well they can lead a group of their colleagues in a mock attack. It's difficult to get other people to follow orders that could easily get them killed unless they have complete confidence in your judgment.
And reorg approximately 50 meters out. I'll tell you when. Charge!
Dead, you motherfucker.
Hey, let's go! Fire and move it! Go, mate!
Okay, go, Hop! Come on, fire!
Let's go! Move it up!
Well, it wasn't as bad as the second one.
This man is a trained soldier who wants to become an officer. He was in command of the last mock attack.
What do you think of it? They came out of the bush line too early. With the C2 group up there, they walked right into our line of fire.
The Army doesn't really care whether his attack succeeded. What it needs to know now, before he gets any further, is whether he can make decisions well under pressure and project the kind of warrior image that will persuade men to follow him.
Now, why did you decide on the right flanking initially? I believe that there would have been more cover fire from the right side.
Did you have a look?
Just have a look now. The scrub and the small bushes.
Now look to the left. What do you have?
Forest. Plus the road, the dead ground.
Did somebody mention it, left flanking? Somebody in the session?
I did.
That's okay. I don't care if you help each other out. But like I told you before, make your plan. And if you start switching plans after you pass it on to your section, what does it do to them?
Loss of confidence.
They're going to say, to hell, I'm not following them anywhere, am I?
This would-be officer was sent back to his unit the next day.
This is where George handed me the thunder flash and said, boom.
Yeah, you were probably picking raspberries.
Did you lose? I heard that you people lost a guy yesterday.
Yeah, one man, one home.
Yeah.
He had trouble in leadership tests, so it was decided that that was it from this year. And depending on how he does at his unit during the year, they'll decide whether he'll have the chance to come back or not if he develops his leadership during the year.
What do you mean by leadership?
The ability to lead men, to coordinate, to have your control of people, to have them do the right things at the right time. It's some people say you're born with it, others say you develop it. I think it's something that's developed.
Mostly what we're looking for is if they can command, if they can get what they want done across to the people and have it done in the way they want it carried out. And if people aren't following their instructions, to get on them and get it sorted out. If a guy doesn't have it, you can tell when he crosses the start line. Just by his attitude, his reaction, his indecisiveness. When things start to go wrong, he doesn't get a grip on things. He doesn't straighten it out.
What are the implications of that come the day of the battle if he can't get it right then?
If he can't do it right then, his men are going to die. Simple as that.
Or he's going to come down and swing south and come in as the second echelon back against us.
Battalion staff, 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry, U.S. Army.
And for me, it's a question of follow me, do as I do. And it's a question of confidence. And I tell all my people that the only thing that I'm interested in is killing more Russians, lots of Russians. And if we're unable to do that, then obviously something that we're doing is wrong.
Colonel Bigelow's tough soldierly image had a very functional purpose when he was a junior officer in Vietnam leading a small group of men under fire. But now that he's a colonel, his real job in a war, just like Dan Lanner's on the Golan Heights in 1973, is to stay on the radio. That's the only way he can control the 800 men under his command, most of whom he'll never see during a battle. And, of course, he's never been in command of a whole battalion in a real war.
Or if there's any kind of a difficulty,
I'll follow right along.
We're going to fire a 5-minute prep.
Well, where are the current locations?
Armies spend most of their lives in peacetime. In fact, armies are remarkably non-violent organizations, except when they're let off the leash and told to go and fight. And as combat becomes an ever more complicated business, armies must go to ever more bizarre lengths to simulate the real thing. Today's middle-level officer has become a sort of choreographer of violence in three dimensions, orchestrating infantry, tanks, guns, missiles, even aircraft, spread out over hundreds of square miles and always on the move. The only way to train the commanders is by constant practice in conditions as realistic as possible, but not so realistic that anybody gets killed. So one of the devices the U.S. Army uses to get around the problem is this, the Combined Arms Tactical Training Simulator. Certainly the world's most impressive video war game.
We have
These are Colonel Bigelow's company commanders. In a real battle, they'd be down on the front lines, getting orders from the colonel and passing information back to him. Here at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, a computer is the enemy, and the information only goes to the colonel's staff in the room next door. Even in a real war, the practical side of the colonel's job is somewhere between that of an air traffic controller and a personnel manager. He could get killed doing it, and so could his officers, but what they're actually doing is controlling and monitoring the expenditure of vehicles, troops, and ammunition.
He's combat effective. He just has one platoon that's ineffective.
Most significant difficulty for us is the proper way of putting combat power to work on the battlefield. Who controls the fires? Do we let the individual gunner fire each missile? We expended a heck of a lot of missiles in this last battle, shooting at targets that might have been destroyed with artillery or another means. And, you know, each one of those missiles is $2,500, $3,000 a piece.
In a modern infantry division, only a small fraction of the soldiers are actually operating weapons. Collectively, they can do a great deal of damage, but the reality of combat for most of them is not at all the traditional experience of the warrior. Warfare has been affected by the same technological trends that have transformed the rest of our society. The USS John F. Kennedy on the Mediterranean Sea.
It takes the coordinated efforts of 5,500 highly trained people to operate this ship at sea, and at least three times as many people ashore to support it. The organization, the skill, the cooperativeness, the dedication that make this ship possible represent the very best of our civilization. And what all that effort and devotion have produced here is a marvelously efficient death machine. The sole use for this ship is to kill people and destroy what people have built. In just a few days, it could devastate a fair-sized country all by itself. And in just a few minutes, it and all the people in it could be destroyed by some other death machine.
Yet most of the men on this carrier do not need a warrior's mentality at all. The only people on the carrier whose job would ever involve fighting an enemy they can see are the pilots, who do still need all the traditional military values, and add to them the special mystique of high technology.
Flying fighters is from the Navy standpoint, is pretty much the top of the profession as far as desirability.
We're designed to shoot down aircraft at speeds of 3.0 Mach and that are constantly moving, and they're also trying to shoot us, okay? And so it makes it a whole lot more of a challenge as far as we're concerned.
We carry the heat-seeking Sidewinder missile. That's always launched within visual range of the enemy, because we have to acquire his infrared signature with our own eyes before we can put the missile on. And then for the old Red Baron type dogfight, then we have a 20mm Gatling gun, which fires about 6,000 bullets per minute. Doesn't even sound like a machine gun anymore. It howls like a banshee. It's not the safest profession you'd want to get into.
Even for the pilots, combat is really machine against machine. For everybody else on the carrier, there are even further layers of technology between them and the enemy. And what has always been true for sailors and airmen is increasingly true for ground troops as well. Most soldiers everywhere serve machines now, and machines are very inflexible. No matter where you come from or who you are, you have to mold yourself to their requirements. There's only one right way to operate a tank. For the past two centuries, the individuals who've learned about battle in this room have been Russians.
And the army they served, whether Tsarist or Soviet,
has been a distinctively Russian army. This metal beast behind me and all the other machines that rule modern warfare may gradually be putting an end to that. Mechanization is removing the human element from warfare, and I don't know any serious soldier who doesn't worry about it. What really worries the soldiers is that if it is not their uniquely human soldierly qualities that decide a battle anymore, but just the machines they serve, then the whole basis of their warrior self-image is threatened. That self-image is vital because it shores up the moral armor dividing their world from ours. They kill, but they are not murderers. They die, but they are not accident victims. They are honorable men engaged in a noble struggle. So most soldiers reject the idea that technology is undermining their traditional role.
The most important thing is the man who is using the weapons. It doesn't matter what the weapons are. Assuming he knows how to use the weapons and is well trained, the soldier or officer who will win is the one who thoroughly understands the goals of the war, who is striving to achieve these goals, and who is ready to sacrifice his life in the name of these goals.
Soldiers must believe that the new weapons have not devalued the importance of the traditional soldierly virtues. Otherwise, their actions would no longer have meaning in their own eyes. But the contrast between the soldier's self-image and reality has been made far sharper by the advance of technology. This is the pattern room at the Royal Small Arms Factory Enfield in North London, and here you can see how a century of technological change has undermined the traditional glory of the military profession. This, for example, is the standard British infantry rifle adopted in 1895, the Lee Enfield. It's a superbly made piece of precision machinery, engineered to very fine tolerances, sights out to 2,800 yards. It's also beautiful, and it was made to be so. This stock wasn't sculpted into these complex curves for purely functional reasons. Weapons have always also been objects of art, and in the early industrial era, that tradition still survived. This, on the other hand, is a standard Israeli infantry weapon today, the Uzi submachine gun. Like many modern weapons, it's less well made. Most of its parts are stamped, not machined. But it'll put out a stream of bullets, about 10 per second, that will shred an opponent at close range.
And like most modern weapons, it's also very ugly.
It's still possible, just barely, to associate this Lee Enfield with romantic concepts like glory. The only words called to mind by this Uzi, on the other hand, are efficient, utilitarian, ruthless. Weapons as impersonal as this would horrify soldiers from 200 years ago, who thought it was only honorable to kill opponents face to face. But that was all they could do. As each new weapon has come along, from machine guns to napalm to H-bomb, the military profession has absorbed it without even a hiccup. And the code of the warrior gentleman has proved infinitely flexible. People who have had nuclear weapons under their command can still see their profession in the most shamelessly romantic way.
The military profession makes demands which few, if any, others do. And of course, where emotionally disturbed people talk about being trained to kill, the whole essence of being a soldier is not to slay, but to be slain. You offer yourself to be slain, rather than set yourself up as a slayer. Now, one can get into very deep water here, but there's food for thought in it.
Soldiers are, in fact, both the slain and the slayers. And while nowadays everybody is a potential victim of war, we still leave the business of conducting it to the soldiers. There is a bargain between those who become soldiers and those who stay civilians. It's not written down anywhere, but it exists in every country, whether the soldiers are volunteers or not. We don't just pay our soldiers money. We let them have their own separate society, run mostly by themselves. We offer them travel, adventure, and status. We show them respect when they're living, and veneration if they die.
It's a much better deal than we offer to bus drivers or secretaries. But it seems worth our while as civilians to give soldiers these privileges, because in return they take war off our hands. It becomes their problem and their responsibility, not ours. And it's not a lopsided bargain, because there is a catch for the soldiers. They have to die when we tell them to. But most people join armies in peacetime, so they don't have to do it right away.
None of the young men in this room have been in battle, but that is what they are preparing for. And rituals like this mess dinner are not irrelevant to that goal. It's one of the ways soldiers reaffirm to themselves that they live in a separate and honorable society. In fact, honor, in the traditional sense of the word, something that it was right and necessary to kill and die for, is a central idea in a separate military world. Soldiers need abstract notions like honor and gallantry and glory and sacrifice in order to hide the basic nature of the trade from themselves when they can, and justify it when they cannot. And, of course, the basic nature of the trade is only visible at all in wartime.
Getting away from all the philosophical answers, the reason why I'm here is because it's fun.
Yeah, same here. It is.
And really I enjoy running out there and firing a rifle and charging and yelling and screaming. And I enjoy doing drill. And I like most of the things that have to do with military. I did my degree in military history because I enjoyed military history. I joined the Army because I liked the Army.
I'd known some guys at university who'd gone to Vietnam, and so I kind of got interested in the conflict. And then I saw the movie Apocalypse Now, and I think that did something. And so here I am. This is true, by the way, this is true. A buddy of mine saw it, and he liked the helicopters so much that he put in for pilot training, the helicopters.
Not Apocalypse Now. Reality. Vietnam, 1967.
Who's in charge of 5-2 now?
I can't read.
Who's got 5-2 now?
I had my doubts quite a few times, because I had three men wounded. We had NVA within 3 feet of us. Artillery and airstrike on top of us. We're just lucky to be back here alive.
Thank you.
By the way.
I had six, all right.
Who's coming?
After a while, you develop a sense of invincibility. You go into contacts and you don't really think you're going to be hurt. It doesn't faze you. Even seeing somebody else real in close proximity to you being shot or wounded, it doesn't dawn on you that that could happen to you. I was in country for 9 months before I was wounded. And when I was wounded, that sense of invincibility was lost. And you no longer are watching the guy next to you get hurt. You are actually being hurt. It became frighteningly real when I got wounded. Then it took me about 2 weeks to get over that to where I was not what I would call gun shy. And then I developed that detachment again.
Professional soldiers accept the likelihood of being killed as one of the costs of the profession. Indeed, is what makes it an especially honorable calling. But they still need ways of dealing with the reality of death. One is simply to reject the possibility despite the evidence of their eyes. Another is to concentrate very hard on the technical aspects of the job.
The mission I was shot down on, I was flying an air-to-air combat mission. We were trying to intercept and destroy enemy aircraft.
What got you?
I was shot down by a Soviet-built SA-2 surface-to-air missile.
Did you see it coming?
The one that hit me, I did not see. I was fired upon by two sights. As best I could compute the situation at the time. I had one at roughly in front of me, 11 o'clock or so to my left. And another sight firing back to my left, about left 8 o'clock. And I saw the missiles come out of the clouds at the 11 o'clock position. I called them out to the flight, told the flight to break left into the missile. And at that time, the rear seat pilot in my aircraft said he was watching a missile come into the back seat with him just as I turned upside down. The missile exploded, blew one wing off the aircraft, blew the tail off the aircraft, left us in the front torso spinning and burning. And when you get shot down, you're going to a state of shock. I must have been in a state of shock because I remember vividly what I was doing, and I wasn't screaming and jumping up and down and upset. I was upset with the fact that I'd been hit by a missile, and my airplane wasn't going to fly, because when it hit my aircraft, I had all of the taillight caution lights light up on the taillight panel, fire lights and overheat lights. Everything went tick, tick, pop, 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 and the stick went flop, 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 flop. And I remember saying to myself, I don't think this thing is going to fly. And of course, one wing was gone, the tail was gone, and I was right.
I honestly believe that if someone fights professionally, he can minimize the risks a whole lot and survive on the battlefield. At least to an extent that provides you some personal belief that if something is going to happen, it's going to happen to him, not to you. And that's very important. You know, you go to a battle and you always look around and you think that you are going to survive to tell the story. You know, if something happens, it will happen to him. So that's the way I think about it. So far it works.
Dealing with the fact that your job may get you killed is difficult, but everybody has to face death sooner or later. Dealing with the fact that your job involves deliberately killing human beings, people who are not evil but simply foreigners, is different. Soldiers are the only human group that has this sort of license to kill, a duty to kill in certain circumstances, and that is not an easy thing to live with. When you listen to soldiers talking about killing, what you're hearing is men telling themselves that they can do the terrible things their profession demands, and that doing them is morally okay.
As far as I was concerned, I was a professional soldier doing my job, and I would assume that they were a professional soldier doing their job, and they were trying to neutralize me, I guess, and therefore, you know, I had to do the same. So,
would you say neutralize? You mean kill, don't you?
I'll expand on that. Neutralize, you want to take them out of action. If you have to kill them to do that, then you have to kill them, yes. But if you can do it in some other way, you're not going to kill just for killing's sake. That's not the point of combat, at least as far as I was concerned. It was to neutralize the enemy. And if you wounded him and took him out that way, he was no longer a threat.
I can remember vividly shooting a man. I happened to be at the right location at the right time when some of our soldiers had been fired upon and hit, and I jumped in a helicopter and went out to try to find the bad guys. We did flush out, in fact, some bad guys, and there wasn't any doubt in my mind that was finally the time to put someone in the sights of the rifle and do it. I wasted a bunch of rounds, and again, My training had taught me otherwise, but I guess in the excitement, I put too many rounds into one individual. There was no second thoughts. In this particular case, it was so easy to do because it was a directly retaliation for. I saw our soldiers laying there all shot up. This was a very natural thing as a trained soldier to do.
Most of the time, there's no personal feeling there. He's a soldier. You know his job is to win over you. Your job is to win over him. There was one incident that bothers me. It was three individuals, and they were the part that bothers me is they didn't know that I was there. They were smoking and joking, carrying on like walking down Michigan Boulevard, and. We set a claymore off on them. We were in a place we weren't supposed to be, a secure place to them, and it ended for them.
Can you tell me why it feels different?
I could have let them gone by. I think that's the key. They didn't know we were there. We could have maintained our silence, and they could have moved right on through. But I chose at that point, we needed some material, and I chose at that point to detonate the Claymore. It was my decision. The other times, my decision was taken away from me. I was reacting rather than acting.
Tactically, Major Uhle did everything right. The Vietnamese soldiers he killed were legitimate targets, and nothing in the rules said he should warn them first. He feels bad because he's a human being, and they look too much like the people he isn't supposed to kill who walk down Michigan Boulevard at home. But most of the time, even infantrymen do not see the people they kill close up. Artillerymen who shell targets beyond the horizon, or pilots who drop their bombs from 2 miles up, never do. And in turn, today's soldiers are threatened by enemies they seldom see. Death is random and impersonal, but it remains the essence of the soldier's trade. Because men in the military profession have this dramatic, unlimited commitment to kill, and especially to die in the service of others, many civilians romanticize their job. Serious soldiers who've experienced battle understand that killing human beings is always a squalid, ugly business, but they still remain willing to give and receive death. In some very important ways, they are romantics too. They have to be, because the unvarnished reality of their job is too grim to be borne. That's why they need all the old-fashioned romance of high ideals and military glory, and the new romance of glamorous machines. Sometimes the way officers talk about their ideals is almost embarrassing, but they have to think that way.
I was shot down January 23rd, 1967, over North Vietnam, and they took some films of us and whatnot, and then escorted us on into Hanoi, where we began our little ordeal up there for some 6.5 years. The common denominator, which enabled, in my judgment, the American prisoners of war to come home with their heads held high, was the unwillingness of the individuals there to sacrifice their own personal reputation. I absolutely believe that our American values, which are shared throughout the society, and gifts of our forebears, and in my judgment, not values and mores of which we can be proud, because I'd rather use the word thankful. I think it's a much better word. I'm very thankful we have those kinds of attitudes in the country, were what enabled us to overcome the enemy's efforts to exploit us successfully, and in fact, made us unwilling to let one another down. You know, when we lost everything we had, we still had each other.
Now, what Arnold Toynbee used to call the military virtues, fortitude, endurance, loyalty, courage, and so on, these are good qualities in any collection of men and enrich the society in which they are prominent. But in the military society, there are functional necessities, which is something quite different. I mean, a man can be false, fleeting, perjured, in every way corrupt, and be a brilliant mathematician or one of the world's greatest painters, but there's one thing he can't be, and that is a good soldier, sailor, or airman. Now, it's his group coherence and the unlimited liability which, between them, set the military professional apart. And I think we'll continue to do so.
My profession is not just to fight, but to protect my motherland. If aggressive forces impose war on us, like all Soviet soldiers and the whole Soviet people, I would give all my abilities, my experience, and if necessary, my life, to protect my socialist motherland, to achieve the total destruction of the enemy.
How would you feel about going into combat again?
I don't want to go. I started to say I think anyone would be a fool to want to go. I don't want to say that. I would go because I'm a professional soldier, and I take great pride in the fact that I'm a professional soldier. I asked to be a soldier. I chose to be a soldier. I've trained to be a soldier. And I can't think of anything more honorable for me personally than to be a soldier. And that's my job if my country asks me to go and fight. I would do that for myself, for my family, for my country, and for my God. But I don't want to have to do that, but I'm willing to if that comes along.
The military profession is riddled with paradox. Officers really do care about the men under their command, yet they must use up their lives in order to win battles. The trade is now dominated by technology, but those who run it still cling to tradition and ritual. Armies are societies based on order and discipline, and their purpose in battle is to destroy precisely those qualities in other armies. There are no people kinder and more unselfish to each other than soldiers in combat, who are at the very same time trying to kill other people who just wear different uniforms. None of it makes any sense, and yet military men must believe it all does, or they couldn't do their jobs. You have to ignore a lot of reality to be a good soldier. The last time this army fought a major war was in the 1940s. What the soldiers had to face when they got there required every mental defense the army could give them. And when they were finished fighting, the ones that were left still needed to believe in all the ideas that had got them there in the first place in order to shield themselves from the full truth of what they had seen and what they had done.
Media used for this episode are at www.unwelcomeguests.net/511. We have a mailing list at www.altruists.org/unwelcome. You can contact me at unwelcome@altruists.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving.